Hello, this is Outlook. I'm Emily Webb. Today, a story about a man who spent 9 decades learning to be comfortable in his own skin. Stanley Underhill is an English priest who, for most of his life, kept a secret from his family. Tell me how old you were when you told your brother that you were gay.
Oh, not until recently. A few months ago, I told him I was gay and I'd written my autobiography. He didn't raise a hair.
So you were 92 when you told him?
Yes, well, he's 90, and I was 92 when I told him, yes.
When he did react in that way, did it make you wish that you'd told him sooner?
Oh, yes. I mean, I wish I'd have told my family much sooner, but I didn't know how they would take it.
Because when Stanley was growing up in England in the 1930s, being gay was illegal and it would be for years to come. So Stanley, like many men and women, spent a lifetime trying to hide his sexuality.
I've got you a coffee.
Oh, I would love a coffee.
A cappuccino.
When I went to see him at his flat in London, he made me coffee and we spoke about what life was like for him as a child.
I was born and brought up in the middle of the Black Country, a place called Oldbury, which in those days was a very industrial part of the country.
So this is in the Midlands of
the
UK?
And sadly, after my parents married, and my father fell ill. The doctor said he wouldn't live more than 6 months, and he was confined to bed for a couple of years, and consequently we were plunged into dire poverty. That was a very tough existence in those days.
And with your father, what was your relationship like with him?
I had a terrible relationship with my father. The incident to which he reacted very badly was that his sister, my aunt, took me shopping one day, and I wouldn't leave a shop until she bought me this doll dressed in costume, and it was in a small wicker pram. And I can hear him say to my mother, "Just you come here and look at what he's got now." I think he despised me. He couldn't express why. And from that time on, he just rejected me. And for the rest of my teenage years, until I left home and went out to work, he hardly ever spoke to me.
Why do you think that was?
Well, he didn't understand why I behaved so differently to other children.
So you feel like he didn't like the parts of you that he saw didn't fit into this idea of what he thought it was to be a man?
That's right. And you see, my mother used to say to me, "I don't know where you come from. You got ideas I never heard. Where'd you get these ideas from?" I just felt that I was rejected entirely. And I was bullied at school to make it worse.
One of those interests that Stanley's mother didn't understand was his love of music. In particular, opera.
We had an aunt who married quite a wealthy man and he had a radiogram. And occasionally my parents used to take us to my aunt and uncle and he had lots of vinyl records and I used to play opera and classical music. I fell in love with it.
Did you realise that you were attracted to men?
Oh, yes. I remember my first male icon. We used to go to the local cinema, and the local cinema was being played the first space film called The Trip to Mars. And there was a guy, Buster Crabbe, the actor was, and I was attracted to his male form as a boy.
You are privileged to bail out now, if you wish.
When you would have those feelings, did you realise what they were, would you say?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't know who I was. I mean, I had these feelings, but I couldn't explain them, and no one explained them to me. Because, as you know, the word homosexual, it wasn't part of our vocabulary.
So when you were growing up at home, you did have this radio. And one of the reasons that you became interested in Christianity was that you saw Jesus as the underdog.
Yes.
Because you were having such a miserable time.
Well, we were poor, but my father made a cat's whisker.
What is the cat's whisper?
Well, it's a primitive kind of a radio. Then we were able to listen to the BBC Home Service. And at Children's Hour, I think it was on Sundays, they broadcast a book called Man Born to be King by Dorothy L. Sayers, based on the Gospels and the life of Jesus. And I was very impressed with the fact that Jesus was always for the underdog. and always defending the people that were despised and so on. So that image appealed to me, and I took Jesus as my friend.
So obviously the era when you were growing up, the war was happening around you, and in 1945 you were called up and you went and you joined the Navy. What were you doing? What was your job?
I was called up to be what they called a sick berth attendant, a nurse. Mm. I was put on a minesweeper with 80 souls, and all I had was a huge medical manual and 10 weeks training as a nurse. And to face the challenge of people's health on board ship, I was literally terrified.
I mean, it does sound quite scary. So when you were on this ship out at sea, you met a man.
I did indeed.
Who became significant. Who was he? Tell me about him and that first meeting.
Well, it was just after the war, and I was posted to HMS Queen, an escort carrier that was being returned to the States. And we had on board brides, they called GI brides, ladies who had married American servicemen, and they were being returned to America to meet up with their husbands. Anyway, one day, one of the ladies fell down the gangway and broke her femur. So I assisted her to the operating theatre, and then I fainted for the sight of so much blood, because it was a breaking in the femur and it was a very serious fracture. Anyway, and so they sent me out, and they appointed another SBA to go and look after me and bring me round. His name was Alex, and when I opened my eyes, I found him looking at me. He was saying something to me, and I didn't hear what he was saying, but our eyes met, and I fell in love with him. When I fell in love, I didn't have any sense of guilt or thought of what people would think of us. In the Navy, although it was illegal, I knew that there was people on board who were what we would call gay, but they were accepted.
When you did deliver all of your GI brides in the US, you then went on a trip together. What was that like, that trip?
We wrote poetry to each other. And we were going down the St. Lawrence River, and of course, either side is forest, and I can still see the golden browns of the deciduous trees and the background of the evergreens and so on. And it was just so romantic. It was lovely.
So you moved back to the UK, and you'd moved in together.
Yes.
Was there a moment, because obviously at the time it was illegal to be gay in the UK. And you said that when you first kind of had that moment of love, that you didn't have any guilt about it. Did that ever kick in?
Well, I mean, the relationships with Alex was wonderful. And it never occurred to me that I was offending the law or being unnatural. It was a natural process. But of course, when I went to work and live with him, I began to realise that this wasn't acceptable. And the father said, I think you better go and find digs of your own, without any explanation.
Did you notice a change in him in the way that he viewed the relationship?
Well, the point was that we were going through a sort of exploratory period investigating our Christian faith. We both began to read the scriptures, encouraged by the Methodist Church which we attended, and he came to the conclusion first that his relationship with me was evil, and he tried to exorcise me.
So tell me about this. So firstly, when he said that to you, I mean, having the person who you love in the world tell you that what your relationship is evil, what was that like?
It was terrible. It was rejection. I felt even more that I didn't know who I was, and I was thrown into absolute chaos.
He then suggested trying gay conversion therapy, so trying to sort of rid you in a way of your homosexuality.
He was convinced after reading the story of Jesus.
When he did that, tell me about that day. What happened?
Well, he was convinced that Jesus could get the devil out of me, exorcise the devil from me. He called homosexuality a devil. Quite ignorant, of course. I mean, in the New Testament, the word devil was used for illnesses, of course. They didn't understand the medical terms as we understand them today. Anyway, he gathered a few friends one November morning and persuaded me for him to place his hands on me and pray. I mean, he got quite excited. I mean, this enthusiasm in his religion. Well, nothing happened. And the result was that he just made me feel damn sight worse than ever I did before.
Did the relationship end after that? What happened?
Well, I went to the doctor and said, look, I'm no good for this world, take me out of it. It was just at the time that they opened the asylums to voluntary patients, otherwise I would have been committed. I spent 3 or 4 weeks having ECT, which was, of course, electric therapy, where they clamp what's-its on your head and so on. In the end, all my friends, except one, wouldn't have anything to do with me. And I had to sell my little bungalow and return home to my mother.
Why wouldn't they have anything to do with you?
Because the word had gone round that I was homosexual. Not that they use those terms, but I was an abomination to God.
So that period of your life, I mean, knowing that you were gay, but then knowing how rejected you were by society, how did you imagine your future at that stage?
Well, it didn't. I mean, I was at a loss to make any kind of assessments of either myself or my future. The consequence of my torments and so on was the fact that I then suffered from periodic depression of a deep sort. I was virtually suicidal many, many times.
When did things start to change then? I mean, in light of how hopeless things were looking for you in that period, when was the first moment you began to feel more optimistic?
Well, coming to London, of course, I realised that there were other people that felt like me, and that somehow gave me confidence that I was not alone. I had affairs with guys I met, but I was never felt free to engage deeply with another person. I was always inhibited by my religious understanding.
During this time, Stanley worked as an accountant until he decided to join the church.
In my teens, I'd always had a feeling, a strong, strong feeling, that I ought to be a priest, despite my reservations on the sexual level. And that feeling persisted throughout my life until in my 40s. I was a partner in a firm.
Accountancy firm.
Yes. Yeah. And they humiliated me in all sorts of terrible ways because I was gay. And so I thought, blow it. I'm going to follow my long-standing urge. So I joined a religious order, the Society of St. Francis, an Anglican religious order, which, by the way, was absent of homophobia. They understood.
So it was a place that you could be open?
It was safe. Yeah. It was a safe place.
How much of a change have you seen? I mean, has there been a particular time where you've suddenly realised that you don't experience the same level of homophobia?
Interestingly enough, our culture has accepted homosexuality far in advance of the church. The church is still culturally locked in old models, and they've not come to terms with modern life. Homosexuals have always been there throughout history, but never recognised and silenced by the law, of course. And the church is still coming to terms with that cultural move.
Why, therefore, do you choose to be part of it, if it does have that very difficult relationship with homosexuality?
It's the only organisation historically that perpetuates the history and the work of Christ. The message of Christ was hope and life and so on. I don't see why I should give up the church because of their folly.
Now, the reason I'm sitting in Stanley's flat and hearing about his life, the way I heard about what happened to him, is because of a book he published in 2018. Why was it that you did decide to write a book?
Because of my deep depressions, I used to go to a counsellor. And he said one to me one day, he said, you know, the only way I think that you would ever be free of these depressions is that you write it out in an autobiography. And I thought, well, that's very self-centred. Anyway, I thought about it, and I thought, well, it could be helpful to others. So that's what I did. I mean, it was a long process.
And after so many years of really struggling and feeling so much shame and also not being open about your sexuality, what was it like to be so open about it?
Yes. I mean, it was freedom at last, free from all the demons of the past. I mean, there's a famous saying in Shakespeare, be true to thine own self. Suddenly I found myself. I found who I was and accepted who I was and was happy about who I was.
And how old were you when that happened?
91. It was published in October last year.
How do you reflect on that? I mean, that it's at 91 that at last you've accepted yourself.
How do I feel? Well, great. But then, of course, you've got the thoughts, well, wouldn't life have been different had you come to this understanding years ago? And in one sense, I do feel very, very deprived of the fact that I've never been able to establish a relationship and experience love in its full sense.
When you look back on the more difficult periods of life, I mean, I'm thinking particularly of when you were suicidal. I suppose so many people who are suicidal do not see a point in carrying on. How do you reflect on your younger self wanting to take his own life?
I don't know how I came across Albert Camus, who in one of his books says this. He said, it takes more courage to live than it is to die, to take your own life. And somehow I found the courage to carry on, and I press on because I've got life. As long as God gives me life, I will press on.
Stanley Underhill. To see a photo of him, there's one up on our Facebook page. Just search for BBC Outlook.